Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month. Our next call will be on March 6th, so please mark your calendars. And I got to say, this is the first one for the year, so Happy New Year to everyone that's on here. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work, because we do have a lot of new people attending today. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then congratulations. That means you've logged in correctly, because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today. We ask for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions, and time permitting, we will open it up for the rest of you on the line. We will announce when the Q&A session has begun and ask that you please type in the question box your name as you entered it while logging onto the call and that you have a question. We will then unmute you when we call upon you to ask your question. We will select participants in the order when you submit in your name in the question box. Once we unmute you, you will be prompted by a system that you have unmuted, that you have been unmuted, and you will now be able to speak to, for all of us to hear. In addition to coming on live, you can also type in your question in the questions box if you're a little shy and you don't want to come on and for everyone to hear. So that's an alternative. All right, so now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have two members of our staff. Let's start first with Norman. Everyone recognizes Norman as the head of our legal department here at the Tax Resolution Institute. And Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxing agencies. In addition to Norman, Matthew Cohen is our Chief Strategy Officer, and he joins us on this call today to help us with some of these marketing and sales questions that we have. So, ladies and gentlemen, here's Norman.
Good morning, everybody. Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. Each Tuesday, TRI offers something great. On the first Tuesday of each month, like today, this practitioner's call is offered. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. On the second and fourth Tuesdays of each month, we offer Tax Tuesday lightning deals. Be sure to come back regularly as the offers change each time. Get free stuff, amazing discounts, and much more. And on the third Tuesday of each month, we broadcast our featured webinar. Learn audits, offers, installment agreements, appeals, and much more. If you forget what happens when, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. Remember, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. So let's go ahead and jump right into the questions. As a reminder, subscribers and members get priority with these questions. So the first round here is coming directly from our members. First one is Rebecca. She's a CPA, and she's asking, the California Franchise Tax Board has levied my client's bank accounts here in Texas. My client used to live in California 15 years ago, but hasn't filed returns while living there. We contacted the FTB, and they want her to file the returns. What can I do to make sure the client isn't responsible for California taxes? She holds a California state broker's license in case she ever sells a property there.
So we've had several cases like this with taxpayers living in states other than California and having their bank accounts levied by the Franchise Tax Board. So on an analysis like this, my first question would be, which years was the taxpayer assessed for? So what that's called is a filing enforcement, where the Franchise Tax Board determines that the taxpayer was required to file a return but didn't. And so they prepare a return on the client's behalf. It's somewhat similar to the IRS substitute for return, but it's based on a notice or proposed assessment. So the first question would be, which years was the taxpayer assessed for? Because if they were assessed for years, you know, going back 15 years ago, you may not want to file a return because the statute for collections in California is 20 years, unlike the statute for the IRS, which is only 10 years. But the thing is, if the taxpayer files a return, then that statute would start all over again. So if this assessment is 15 years old and is going to expire in 5 years, I wouldn't see the advantage of filing a return now and setting the clock back to zero and having another 20 years. The other question is, when the taxpayer moved from California to Texas or wherever, did they still make income in California? And if so, were they required to file, if not a California resident return, then a California non-resident return? Did they have property in California? Did they have earnings in California? So in this case, I don't know. So I don't know if the taxpayer sold property in California and therefore earned the commissions were earned in California, even though they lived somewhere else and they were subject to California taxes. There's just so many questions that to ask and have answered before I could tell you what to do. But I think the first step would be to find out what years they owed for, get copies of the notice of proposed assessments from the FTB and see if they're accurate or not. Because when they prepare the returns, they use a lot of assumptions that may or may not be true. For instance, they look at similar people in similar occupation, and they look at what the average, let's say in this case, real estate broker, what the average real estate broker makes in California. And so they assess the taxes based on what the average broker would make. If this person made much less, then that would be a consideration. So try to get as much information as you can from the Franchise Tax Board. But I wouldn't necessarily suggest filing returns at this late date. And also I would check to see if California continues to request that they prepare California returns, because they may not be required to file returns to California at this point. So I'm not sure if the returns that they're being asked to file were when they were living in California or when they were living somewhere else but still earning in California.
Thank you, Norman. Hopefully, Rebecca, that answers your question there. Moving on to the next one, this is Patricia, also a member, and Patricia is asking, how can you tell when the CSED date begins and ends? What am I looking at when I have the account transcript in front of me?
Yeah, so unfortunately, account transcripts usually don't have the CSED date. So what you need to look at is the date that the tax was assessed. So it's not the date that the return was filed, because it takes them a while to process the return. It's the date that the tax was assessed, and it's 10 years from that date. But then there are certain events that can toll the statute. So you need to look and see if there were any appeals, if there were any bankruptcies, if there were any offers submitted, if there were installment agreement requests submitted, if the taxpayer lived outside the United States for a period more than 6 months. So all those need to be taken in consideration, because those events toll the statute. But if there's no tolling, then it would be 10 years from the date of the assessment of the tax. And remember, if there are more than one assessment, each assessment has its own CSED date. So some of the tax could be non-collectible sooner than some other. Like, for instance, they filed a return. Tax was assessed based on the return, and then there was an audit. An additional tax was assessed from the audit. So the audit assessment would be have a separate CSED than the assessment based on the return.
All right, Patricia, there you go. Moving on to Juliet. Juliet is also a member, and I've actually had the pleasure of speaking to Juliet a couple times over the phone. So welcome, Juliet, and here's your question that you submitted to us. So client owes $48,000 to the IRS. We know that the client won't qualify for an offer in compromise because there's about $250,000 in equity in the property. He has borrowed money to pay his taxes. Is there a way to ask for a discount since the debt will be paid off? Is it better to call the IRS for some kind of settlement or resolution, confirmation, or will all be resolved once client makes his payment to the IRS website? In other words, what do I do next?
Sure. So I get this question a lot, and the IRS doesn't negotiate settlements. I guess the closest thing to a settlement is an offer, because an offer and compromise, you're seeking to pay less than you owe, and there's a process that you need to go through. So we already know that this taxpayer doesn't qualify for an offer. So otherwise, is there a discount for paying off the taxes that you owe? And the answer is no. The only thing I could think of is if there's penalties, there may be grounds to have the penalties or a particular penalty abated. And the two most common reasons to have a penalty abated, one would be under the first-time penalty abatement program, where you would call the IRS and just simply ask them, does the taxpayer qualify for first-time penalty abatement? And the IRS would check the computer and determine whether or not they've owed in the past and what their record is and whether this is kind of a one-time thing or not. And they could tell you right then whether or not they qualify for the first-time penalty abatement program. The other grounds for abating a penalty is under what's called reasonable cause. And reasonable cause is usually one of two things, is either for some reason the taxpayer couldn't comply, and that's because they were in the hospital, they were sick, they for some reason they couldn't do what normally needs to be done, and they've got a good excuse. The other is that they relied on professional advice, and that advice was an error. So they relied on a tax attorney or an accountant or an enrolled agent who gave them incorrect advice, and that's reasonable cause. So other than penalty abatement for one of those two reasons, there's really no grounds for the IRS to discount what's owed, and the taxpayer just needs to pay it all as soon as they can to avoid continuing interest and penalties.
All right, Juliet, give us a call back if you have any further questions on that. Moving on to the next member. This is Charles. And Charles is asking, we find it a peculiar question, but this question is, taxpayer mistakenly filed as married filing joint. Taxpayer was never married. IRS will not accept amended returns for single. What is the best way to handle? And I'm going to pass this on to Matt to answer that question.
Good morning, everybody. As Joe mentioned, this is a pretty unusual question. And the IRS is pretty clear that you cannot amend a return to single. But I think that applies to a married person filing a single return, not a single person filing a single return. So a rule's a rule, and calling the IRS, you're probably going to get that response. The question is, what is the difference in liability, and is there a potential fraud? I mean, you sign a return under penalty of perjury that the information is correct, and this person signed that they were married when they clearly weren't. So I would call and mention what happened, that it was an erroneous mistake, and see if you can indeed amend the return, which I don't know the answer to that question. If not, I would probably write a letter stating what happened. So if and when they adjust the return, there's no fraud issue there.
All right, Charles. Yeah, sorry we couldn't be more of help there. But yes, this is a unique question. We've had questions be one way, but not the other. Norman, any input on that?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't say here. So they mistakenly filed as married filing joint. But, I mean, if they weren't married, there wasn't a spouse's name on the return. There wasn't a spouse's social security number on the return. There wasn't a spouse's signature on the return. So it seems to me that the return would be invalid and that they could then file it.
Here at the Tax Resolution Institute, we use tax software. And to Norman's point, it wouldn't get through our system, but maybe it was some preparer that did it manually. I don't know, but that's a good question. Did the preparer or taxpayer, are they basing this on having filed the return without acknowledgement of acceptance, or is it still in limbo? Maybe they're going to get a note that the return's invalid, as Norman said.
And was the return paper filed or e-filed?
I would guess paper, because to your point, yeah, if it's any decent program, it's going to reject.
Charles just chimed in. He says, yes, there was. He has a live-in girlfriend. I think he did it to save on taxes now. It is messing up his immigration paper filed and accepted years ago. So it looks like the return was accepted years ago.
We didn't hear that answer. No, but I would do what he can to fix it, but at very least write some correspondence, and good luck to him in his endeavors.
Thank you, Charles, for clarifying that. Moving on to Enrique. Enrique says he needs some help with offering tax resolution services outside of his physical area. Where do I start as far as marketing, advertisements, etc.? Do I need to use programs like TeamViewer, Skype? Can you share your best practices on how to handle these cases when the client is not in your office?
That is actually a really good question, Enrique. It's Matt here again. If you want to practice outside your local area, tax resolution is a great thing to do. It's more like applying for a loan than it is a tax return. If you're looking to get tax clients, it's a harder sell to get that information from someone without meeting them face to face. We have clients nationwide, and in fact worldwide. We have either U.S. citizens or people outside of the U.S. that are required to file returns that we do work for in Canada, Hong Kong, and other places. The key is to get a client's trust, and the way you would do that is over the phone. So you have to have a good sales pitch, and more importantly, you have to be able to get clients, and I assume that's where Enrique is going more on this point. The way we do that and get the most bang for our buck is email marketing. And to do email marketing, you need a list. Luckily, the federal government, and this is public information, publishes tax liens filed for both individuals and businesses. You can go and you have to pay for it usually, but you can get this information relatively cheaply, and you get a person's name, address, and I believe phone number, which doesn't help you for email marketing, but you can either do research if you have time. Small operation, you can do research yourself and build a list with emails. What makes more sense is if you have a few dollars to spend is to append that list. There's our companies online that will give you, you give them the information and they will give you emails. It's a great way to reach a lot of people for a relatively low amount of money. Another thing to consider is social media marketing. I assume everyone in listening here has heard of LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. It is important that you guys have a business page. It costs you nothing to do. It's all free. And it's not enough. You have to participate. And the easiest way to do that is to read other people's stuff and comment and like. You don't have to do a lot of stuff. If you do have the time, write articles and post it, but that's not necessary. We recently, I think it was last week, Joe, settled a $210,000 liability for $1,800 via an offer and compromise for a client that found me personally on LinkedIn. So this stuff really does work. If you want to take this to the next level, check out our website. We actually have a sales and marketing kit. And if you want to include some more on resolution, there's a bonus pack you can get. Joe, can you send them a link for that?
Yeah, I'm going to push it right now.
Thank you very much, Matt. Yeah, everyone, look at the link that I'm pushing now. It does have a lot of cool information on sales and marketing tools for professionals, teaching you guys how to be able to market your services. While I push this link, I'm going to go ahead and read the next question. This is from Dianesh. Dianesh is asking, if a client has money taken from their bank account by California, what can we do to get the money back?
Okay, so the way this works is, it doesn't say whether it's the IRS or the franchise tax board, and that matters because they have different amount of time that they instruct the bank. But the way it works is a bank levy is usually what's called a blind levy in the sense that the taxing agency, the IRS or the franchise tax board, doesn't know how much the taxpayer has in the account. It only knows that there's an account on the taxpayer's social security number. So they instruct the bank to hold the money. And again, it varies by taxing agency, but somewhere between 14 and 21 days. And for those 14 and 21 days, the bank's instructed to freeze the money and hold it, not to send it to the taxing agency yet. So that's the time frame. That's the window that we have in order to either modify the bank levy or release the levy, depending on what we work out with the taxing agency. So you need to contact the taxing agency immediately, because what happened is the taxing agency has been sending the taxpayer notices and requests for payment for months or years and hasn't received any response. And so they pretty much do this in order to get the taxpayer's attention. Okay, so now they have the taxpayer's attention. Now what? So the taxpayer, usually through representation, needs to contact the taxing agency and work out some kind of payment plan or some hardship or currently non-collectible status or something where the taxing agency will either release the levy. In that case, they instruct the bank, and it's good to have the bank's fax number on hand so that you can give the taxing agency the bank's fax number and they can fax the release to the bank right away. Or sometimes rather than releasing the bank levy, they do what's called a partial release or a modification, which instructs the bank to hold X amount of dollars and then release the rest. So let's say you work out a payment plan with the IRS for $500 a month and you say, okay, keep $500 from the bank as the first month's payment on the payment plan and release the rest. So they'll do something like that. That's a partial release. So the fact that there's been a bank levy doesn't mean that all that money is necessarily lost and gone. And it's a lot easier to get that levy released or modified than to have it lapse and have the bank send the money to the taxing agency and try to get the money back. Number one, it's really hard to get it back. And number two, it takes forever. So you really need to act immediately as soon as the taxpayer has knowledge of a bank levy, to get a copy of that levy, to call the taxing agency, and to work out something in which case that levy will be released or partially released.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Also, the trying to get in front of it before that happens is probably the best way to do it, but yes.
Right, but unfortunately, a lot of taxpayers don't come to us for help until after something like this happens.
That's very true. All right. Thank you very much, Janesh. Hopefully that answers your question and gives you some good pointers. Moving on to John. John is asking the question, how do you calculate the amount of the deductible term insurance premium on an offer in compromise?
Yeah, so the term insurance premium would just be an insurance expense, and it either goes on the line for insurance or for other expenses. And the thing is, term life doesn't have any face value, so it's not an asset. And usually the IRS will accept term life insurance premium as a legitimate expense. And so it would reduce your disposable income, which would, depending on whether you're multiplying by 12 or 24, reduce the amount of the disposable income part of the offer. Because remember, the offer amount is a combination of disposable income multiplied by 12 or 24, depending on the terms of the offer and the value of the assets.
And there's no guideline for the insurance premium either, right? So they'll accept whatever the cost is?
Yeah, as long as you can. The important thing is that you can prove it.
Right. There you go. Hopefully that answers your question, John. Moving on to Tony. Tony, we used to determine if someone made too much income to be a dependent, if they earned income that exceeded one exemption. Now that there is no amount allowed for exemptions, what dollar figure is used to make the income determination? So what Tony's asking here is related to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And we've gotten a lot of questions related to this. And unfortunately, we don't have the time to go over all these questions here in this particular venue. But we do have an upcoming event on February 20th where we go into a lot of detail on the major changes that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act are going to enact. So I'm going to be pushing a link and invite everyone here to attend. It is a free webinar. You do get CPE credit for it. The Tax Cut, as everyone knows, and Jobs Act of 2017 was introduced on November 2nd and signed into law on December 22nd. In that time, numerous contradictory changes came and went and made national headlines. In this course, we explain the major final changes to the tax law and how it will affect you and your clients. So get caught up on what the changes are. Make sure that everyone is well-versed. And Peter Steffen is going to be doing that event again February 20th. I'm going to be pushing the link now. It is a free event, so please go ahead and sign up, and we look forward to seeing you guys there. So, Tony, go ahead and sign up. I'm pushing the link now. Moving on to Bonnie. Bonnie's asking, when a lien is placed on real estate, do subsequent interest and penalties get added to that lien?
So the answer is yes. A lien, tax lien, is just the assessed tax at the time that the lien is filed, and that amount of the lien can go up or down depending on whether or not there's accrued penalties and interest, or whether the taxpayer has paid down the lien. So the amount on the lien is not the payoff balance, just like the amount of a mortgage is not the payoff balance. And just like on a mortgage where it says this is not, you know, the payoff balance, call and you need to call and get the exact payoff balance for a particular date. The same thing's true with the lien, is that you even the account transcript says this is not a payoff balance. So you need to call the IRS and get a payoff balance and pay that to get the lien released. The lien that's been recorded is static, but the amount that's owed in order to get that lien released is going to be more or less than the amount on the actual recorded lien.
All right. There you go, Bonnie. Moving on to Audrey. Last year, I helped my client with establishing a streamlined installment agreement. He just contacted me saying that the payment of $300 a month is too much for him and can't continue to pay it. Can I amend the streamlined installment agreement? If so, how?
Okay, so what you need to do is no longer streamline. What you need to do is you need the taxpayer to complete a 433F, and then you need to call the IRS and explain that he's in an streamlined installment agreement but can no longer make the payments. If the original amount was $300, that tells me that he probably owed somewhere around $25,000. So now he can no longer afford the $300 a month, so you need to complete a 433F, and based on the income and expenses on the 433F, the IRS will determine whether or not he can qualifies for a lower payment amount, or whether or not whether he's come in some kind of hardship or something, whether or not he qualifies for currently non-collectible. But yeah, the advantage, one advantage of a streamline agreement is that you don't have to submit a documentation of income and expenses. But if you're going to pay less than the amount of a streamline agreement, which is usually the amount that you owe divided by 72 months, then you need to do a collection information statement, 433F, to determine what the taxpayer's ability to pay is. And if you do that, you could get into a new agreement with a lesser monthly payment.
All right. Yeah, and remember, the streamlined installment agreement is a combination of how much they owe and the amount of time, usually 6 months. So, yeah, 433F is the way to go. Moving on to James. When calculating the assets on an OIC, what happens when the client has equity in a personal residence that they can't tap because of federal tax liens, particularly when the bank refuses to subordinate? Do you subtract the equity portion from the offer?
No, you would not subtract the equity portion from the offer because the taxpayer, for one reason or another, can't tap into it. Because if that property was sold, the IRS would get paid. So the IRS is not going to accept less just because the taxpayer can't get a home equity loan or otherwise tap into the equity of the home while maintaining the home. Because the whole purpose of the lien is to protect the IRS from the taxpayers selling his home and absconding with the equity. So the offer would have to provide on the value of the asset portion of the offer for the equity in the home based on what the IRS would get if the taxpayer sold his house.
Right. Okay. Hopefully that helps you there, James. Moving on to Pete. Pete is asking, I'm new to tax resolution and have only had experience with setting up installment agreements online. How do you decide what the best method to resolve a client's tax problem is? What is your process? Any guidance would be helpful.
So I kind of have a checklist in my mind that I go through when I interview a taxpayer or prospective client. So the first question I would ask is, number one, how much they owe. Number two is, have all returns been filed? And at this time of the year, you want to ask them, are you going to owe on the 2017 return? Because that's important. And then the question is, on the amount that they owe, do they agree with that amount or do they disagree with the amount? So if they disagree with the amount, then the job becomes not so much collection as resolution, dispute resolution. And the answer is, do I need to do an offer doubt as to liability, or was there an audit And has a 30-day letter gone out? Has the 90-day letter gone out? Does the tax courts have jurisdiction? So those kinds of questions, so you have to determine whether or not the taxpayer agrees with the liability or not. So if they say that they agree with the amount that they owe, they're not disputing it, then the question becomes one of payment. So the first question is, can the taxpayer full pay the tax liability within the next 60 to 90 days? Do they have the money in the bank? Can they take out a home equity loan? Can they borrow from friends or family? And the answer is no. Then you need to do an analysis and determine whether or not the taxpayer can fully pay the tax liability within the collection statute, or can they not fully pay within the collection statute and they need to submit what's called a partial pay installment agreement as opposed to a full pay installment agreement, or are they in some kind of hardship situation and do they qualify for currently not collectible, with the emphasis on currently, because currently not collectible doesn't mean that they're permanently non-collectible. It just means maybe they're in between jobs or they just started a new job and the commissions are low or whatever. And so currently non-collectible is a status that the IRS can keep a taxpayer in for up to 2 years before they re-examine the taxpayer's financial situation and determine if whether or not they're no longer and currently non-collectible and they're now in collectible status, and then how much can the taxpayer pay. And then finally, there's offer and compromise where the taxpayer is going to be making some kind of lump sum offer to compromise their tax liability. And that has to do with the amount of the disposable income plus the amount of equity in the assets that they have. So they may or may not be a good candidate for an offer. Not everybody is. But that's the kind of thinking that would go through any analysis with a taxpayer on what it is that we can do to help them. And I would say that we can usually help almost everybody unless they're capable of full paying within the next 60 to 90 days, in which case they really don't need any help, then we could help them with an installment agreement, either full pay or partial pay, an offer, or currently non-collectible status, something like that to help them.
All right, guys. We only have a couple more questions here that were previously submitted, so we are going to get a chance to open up the line. So those of you who are online and have questions that you want to pose, maybe you need a follow-up to something that we've already addressed or something is unclear, go ahead and submit. Begin submitting your questions now, and once we get through the rest of these pre-submitted questions, I'll go ahead and start reading them off to Norman. So moving on to Sabrina. Sabrina's asking, is there a maximum penalty amount that can be abated under the first-time penalty abatement program? Can the FTPA program be applied to both individuals and businesses, and how difficult is it to deal with the IRS on the FTPA program?
Okay, so the first-time penalty abatement program is actually kind of simple. First of all, there's no maximum penalty amount that can be abated. We're working on one right now where the penalty is $80,000. So the question is, can it be applied to both individuals and businesses? And the answer is, again, yes. They just have to qualify. And the easiest way of doing that is calling the IRS and telling the representative that you have a taxpayer client who you think may qualify for the first-time penalty abatement program. And they'll ask you a series of questions, and they'll put it into their computer, and they'll press a button, and it will come out either yes, they qualify, or no, they don't. And that's pretty much it. Now, it used to be where the computer was kind of fixed, because whatever you put in, it would say that they didn't qualify. And I had a friendly representative working with me, and he would ask a question. I would say the answer, and then he would say, oh, no, they don't qualify. And then he'd say, let me ask you that question again, and you can give me a different answer. And I'd give him a different answer, and he would try it, and would say, no, they don't qualify. It would basically, you know, yes, no, maybe. And every answer we gave, it showed that they didn't qualify. So there were a lot of complaints about that, and they reprogrammed the computer or whatever, and now it's pretty good, and it will tell you if they qualify or not. So it could be as simple as a phone call. It's harder just to get through than it is to actually have the question answered. So the answer is to call the IRS and have them do the work.
All right, moving on to Josh. Josh says, I appealed the audit findings for my client and my appeal was denied, and I want to take it one more step. Can a CPA petition the tax court? I may call you to discuss the particulars so I don't feel the IRS is being fair with my client's audit.
Yeah, so when you say that you appealed, I'm thinking you appealed the 30-day letter, and that was denied, and so the IRS submitted the 90-day letter, which is a notice of deficiency, which gives the taxpayer 90 days to file a petition in tax court. And a CPA can petition tax court, but first they have to be admitted and they have to get a tax court bar number. So I'm admitted to tax court. I've been admitted to tax court for, I don't know, 20 years or something. And when I do a petition or anything, I need to provide my tax court bar number, which is different than my California attorney bar number. It's a unique number that the tax court issues. So you need to do that. And I think in order to get admitted, it's been so long ago, I think you need somebody to kind of sponsor you or to vouch for you or something. But you can ask tax court how to get admitted. And then you need to submit a petition within the 90 days of the notice of deficiency. And you send that petition along with other documentation and a filing fee, which I think is $60, to tax court in Washington, D.C. And then you'll hear back from them, and then the IRS files an answer to the petition, and then it gets assigned to a IRS local counsel, and then you could work it out with local counsel. I mean, something like 93% of tax court petitions get settled and never actually end up going to a court, to a tax court trial. And in fact, I've never taken a case all the way to a trial, because I've always settled favorably with the IRS first. So it's really just another bite of the apple. And it will give you an opportunity to dispute the audit and either show documentation of expenses or whatever it was to another person, and hopefully get the results that you're looking for.
All right.
But do feel free to call us to discuss how tax court petition works. Because frankly, if I wasn't an attorney, I'm not sure I could figure some of that out, because there's motions that you need to prepare and status conference reports and stuff like that that a tax lawyer would be familiar with. I'm not sure a CPA would be.
All right, Josh, we look forward to taking that call from you. Moving on to Heidi. Heidi's asking, how long after the statute of limitations expires on collection can the IRS collect from a lien? Can you force the IRS to cancel a lien after the statute of limitation expires on their collections? Or at their discretion, can they keep the lien until the property is sold?
It is a good question because I'm surprised by how many people get this wrong. So an IRS lien expires the same time that the collection expires. The purpose of the lien is to protect the IRS from the taxpayer selling property and, like I said, absconding with the equity while the tax is collectible. But once the tax becomes uncollectible, then the lien is no longer valid. So the lien expires when the collection statute expires. And the way that that happens is the lien is what's called self-releasing, which means on the face of the lien, it actually says this lien is self-releasing and releases when it expires 10 years from the date of collection. Now, the IRS has a window of like 1 year and 30 days to renew the lien and re-record it, but the only reason that the IRS can extend the lien is if the statute has been extended. So if the statute was told for one reason or another, and the collection statute has been extended, then the lien needs to be extended, but only extended as long as the collection statute is extended. So the IRS will renew the lien, but then they're supposed to manually go in and release that lien because the extended lien is not self-releasing as the original lien was. But even though the extended lien may be for another 10 years, it really isn't. It's only as long as the statute's been extended. So if the statute's been extended for a year, then the extended lien is extended for a year. And the Internal Revenue Manual instructs revenue officer to go in and manually release the lien when the collection statute expires, or when I should say when the extended collection statute expires. Otherwise, the lien is self-releasing and releases automatically, and the IRS cannot collect after the statute of collection is expired.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. I'm going to move on to some of the questions submitted online now. This is coming from Clinton. Clinton is asking, should you apply for innocent spouse before or after an active audit has completed? So it's related to innocent spouse.
After, I would say, after. Because the thing is, and for an innocent spouse, you're disputing an assessment, but if the audit hasn't been completed, there's no assessment to dispute.
Right.
So you would do innocent spouse after the audit. And I guess the grounds would be, typical grounds would be, the husband was self-employed, and let's say wife didn't work, and husband and wife sign a joint return, and then the husband gets audited, and expenses on Schedule C or whatever are disallowed, and the wife had no idea that the husband couldn't justify the expenses on the Schedule C and really had nothing to do with it, and they're now divorced, and the wife is just scraping by, and the additional tax would be an undue burden on her, then she could qualify for innocent spouse. But you'd have to wait until the audit became final and the tax was assessed.
Right. All right. John online is also asking, do you use Pitbull, Canopy, or Tax Help software or something else? What tax preparation program do you use? So, yes, we do use, on the resolution side, we do use Canopy. We've used Pitbull in the past, and now use Canopy. We actually are affiliates of Canopy, so if you go to our website, look at our affiliate link, you can actually sign up for a free trial there if you're looking into getting some sort of software to help you. I mean, it's great. It helps with organizing the information. It pre-fills the information to all types of forms, not just the ones that you think you're going to use. So, for instance, if you start working on a 433F and all of a sudden the liability exceeds the limits and it gets assigned to an RO, just by the click of a button, it transfers that information over to a 433A so you don't have to start over again. The transcript, being able to put transcripts is also a great tool that we use on there. Although I'm sure a lot of you have experienced a lot of difficulty with the new dual level or two level authentication that the IRS has implemented. Canopy has made some changes and you can now do that, but there are still a few kinks that I'm sure they're working on. But yes, we do use that software. As far as tax preparation software, we've been using Lacert for a number of years, and you know, we use that. It's very efficient, very effective, and I think it's one of the top softwares out there. So, John, hopefully that answers your question there. Moving on to Howard, also online, and Howard is asking, will tax liens filed for prior tax liabilities be released if the taxes are discharged through bankruptcy?
The answer is yes, but usually not automatically. So what you need to do is contact, it used to be called special procedures, now it's called the advisory group. And after the bankruptcy discharge, and then you need to determine the value of the IRS lien. So does the taxpayer own a home? Is there equity in the home? Does the taxpayer own a car? Is there equity in the car? That kind of thing. And you work out something with the IRS and you pay X amount of dollars, and in exchange they'll release the lien, because the lien isn't automatically removed because of the discharge, and it's a different kind of jurisdiction. It's called in rem jurisdiction as opposed to in personam jurisdiction, and it can kind of trap you. So what you want to do after the bankruptcy discharge, and you use the schedules from the bankruptcy, schedules of personal property and real property, to determine the value of the IRS lien and then negotiate, because they don't want the taxpayer's car or their taxpayer's furniture. They just want to get paid something on their lien if there's a value to it, not the amount that of taxes owed, but the amount, the value of the property that the lien attaches to, and work out something. And you can get that lien released. So, for instance, if the taxpayer has some kind of retirement fund, but he's young and he can borrow against it, sometimes the IRS will say, well, borrow what you can against the retirement fund, give us that money, and then you can pay it back or whatever, and we'll release the lien on it. So it's just an extra step that a lot of bankruptcy attorneys that aren't familiar with tax aren't aware of, and people think that once the discharge is done, that the job is done, but the job is not done if there's still tax liens out there and those liens attach to property.
All right. Hopefully that answers your question, Howard. We're coming down to the wire here in the last 5 minutes up to this month's call. I do have several other questions, but I think we're only going to be able to get to a couple more. So we apologize for those of you online that we didn't get to your questions, but we will keep them. If it's something that needs urgent attention, you can always call us. If you're a member, you can use your consultation time for that. Moving on to Becca. Becca is asking, I have a client that I missed the audit and now is assessed additional tax. It has been over a year since the audit was performed. What is the process to have the audit reopened or to show the expenses?
Yeah, so what this tells me is the 30-day letter came and went. It wasn't appealed, and then the notice of deficiency was issued, and that was a 90-day letter, and a petition for tax court wasn't filed. So now the assessment has become final. What can you do? You can submit an offer doubt as to liability, and you can show the proof of expenses then. But remember, in an offer doubt as to liability, you can't offer nothing. You have to offer something. So I guess if you have proof of some expenses but not other, then you would submit that the some expenses can't be proved, and you would admit to that tax. But then the expenses that you could prove, you would dispute, and that would lower the taxes on that. So a year after the audit, assuming that the 30-day and 90-day letters went out, then the best way to appeal would be through offer doubt as to liability.
So I have a question on a follow-up question to that, Norman. So doubt as to liability, let's say you do accept that some of the liability is yours, but it's still unaffordable. Through the offer and compromise doubt as to liability, are you offering to full pay that at that time, or can you do?
Right, you're going to be assessed with the amount that you admit that you owe.
Right.
But then after that, once the offer is done and the tax has been assessed, you could still do an installment agreement, or you could do an offer doubt as to collectability, or CNC or whatever. This is just for purposes of assessing the taxes. It still allows you to pay through a payment plan or something else.
Got it. So those options are still available afterwards. Right. Okay, good. Jesse is the last one here that we're going to get to today. Jesse is asking, when does the 10-year expiration period start? When the return is filed, when the notice is received, or when the lien is filed?
None of those things. I'm assuming you're talking about the 10-year statute on collection and the expiration of that collection statute, which is the CSED, and it's 10 years from the date of assessment. So the return is filed, and then the account transcript shows the date that that return was received, but then it's processed, and then there's a date that the tax was assessed. So it's the date that the tax was assessed. In terms of the lien file date, that doesn't really matter. The lien is released based on the collection statute, not based on the date that the lien was filed or recorded.
Right. Okay, Jesse, hopefully that answers the question. And yes, everyone, this now brings us to the end of this month's Practitioners Forum. We hope you enjoyed and got some valuable information and tips here. Again, we do apologize for those who we did not get to, but you can join us next month. Next month is March 6th, same time, same location. We'll be sending out the invitation about a week and a half before the actual event, so submit your questions early to make sure that we get you on here and your questions answered. As a reminder, a couple items that we are informing you of today. Matt Cohen was here and talking about the sales and marketing, so I did push a link to the sales and marketing tools for professionals. Take a look at that if it's something that you're interested, sign up for it. And also our upcoming course, February 20th, Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, What You Need to Know, is being held. It's a free event coming up next week on the 20th, a couple weeks from now. But I've also pushed a link for that. I'm going to send that to you one more time. I will stay online here for the next 5 minutes or so if you have any follow-up questions. We are more than happy to take care of those for you. But we look forward to seeing you guys again soon, and definitely on February 20th. Thank you all.